From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. The Inspector General of the Intelligence Community is on Capitol Hill today, testifying behind closed doors as part of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. One person at the center of that inquiry is Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel, chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Congressman, House Democrats are expected to subpoena the White House today for documents that you and others have requested. What are you looking for?
Well, we're after the truth. I think that's the bottom line. And if they have nothing to hide, the White House should give us everything they have so we can better understand what happened. I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me what happened, that the president was trying to essentially blackmail the president of Ukraine by basically saying, we've been very helpful, we've given you lots of aid, we're happy to continue to do that. And by the way, here's a little thing that we'd like to see. So it was quite obvious that there was a quid pro quo, and the president had no right to ask a foreign leader to help him go after his political opponents in exchange for aid that we are supposed to give that country anyway.
Congressman, let's talk a little bit more about what you learned yesterday. So there was over 10 hours of testimony from the former special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker. He testified to your committee and several others. What did you learn that stuck out to you? And we'll talk a little bit about the text messages as well.
What we learned is that our suspicions were corroborated. I mean, that's what we really learned.
What was it about the text messages that really stuck out to you, that it corroborated what you believed happened?
Well, you have, you know, Rudy Giuliani sort of acting as the president's personal lawyer, but also the government. The Ukrainians go to him. There's all kinds of conflicts of interest in the way this was set up, and it just makes me scratch my head to think that the president on down thought this was appropriate behavior.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those text messages. So here's one. The American diplomat Bill Taylor said, quote, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with the political campaign. But then his colleague, Gordon Sondland, responded in the text saying, you're incorrect about President Trump's intentions. The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quo of any kind. The president is trying to evaluate whether Ukraine is truly going to adopt the transparency and reforms that President Zelensky promised during his campaign. Sondland then suggested they stop on back and forth through texts. This text exchange is a direct reference to a quid pro quo, but it also seems to muddy the waters. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree. I think it's clear that the president was talking about a quid pro quo. I mean, otherwise, why do you raise the fact that the United States has been so helpful to Ukraine? And by the way, you should look up what my political opponents are doing. Anybody knows what the president was saying.
Well, Republicans are defending the president. They argue that Trump was trying to investigate, which is now considered a conspiracy theory, that Ukraine interfered with the 2016 election, along with corruption in Ukraine. Your response to that line of defense?
Well, my response is that I think it's a pity that the Republicans are trying to help cover up what the president did. I think they really should look at it from a national security point of view rather than from a Republican Party point of view.
I want to get your thoughts on what Trump said yesterday, that China, quote, should start an investigation into the Bidens. He said he hadn't asked China's president to do that yet or before then. How would you characterize what he said? Is this comparable, you think, to the Ukrainian phone call?
I think it's more bizarre than the Ukrainian phone call. I mean, China, the president's in a trade war with China. China is probably the number one adversary that the United States has in the world. And he's going to ask China, with whom he's feuding, for help against a political opponent of his. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I want to talk a little bit about support. Democratic Oklahoma Congresswoman Kendra Horn said this week that she does not support the impeachment inquiry. She said the allegations are serious, but it should be investigated through some other processes. I want to know how you would direct those Democrats, especially from more conservative districts, who are worried about how this whole process will hurt them politically.
Well, Nancy Pelosi has always said that each member needs to do what he or she needs to do. Each person has got to look at the evidence and decide what is the best course for the country. All of us represent districts, and we must take into consideration the voices in our districts. I mean, when I go around my district, the overwhelming amount of people want to see the president impeached and think that he has violated his oath of office. But I certainly have respect for people who come from different districts who may come to another conclusion. And I just think that we need to get to the bottom of everything, not prolong it, be thorough, and then move on. But if this is not grounds for impeachment, I don't know what is.
Congressman Elliot Engel, Chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
U.S. and North Korean negotiators are due to resume nuclear negotiations this weekend in Sweden, just days after the North conducted another weapons test. The North Koreans launched a new type of ballistic missile from a platform in the sea early Wednesday. Talks between the two sides have been stalled for months, and the latest test, it is an escalation by Kim Jong-un. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's also with MIT's Security Studies program. Jim, it's good to have you back in the studio.
Good to see you, Peter.
And we'll get to the talks, but first, this test, which, as we said, was launched from the sea. Is this some sort of demonstration of a new technology that the U.S. government should be concerned about?
Well, it's definitely worthy of concern. Back 3 years ago in 2016, they had a test from a platform underneath, and it got everyone's attention because, first of all, this is the for them to be able to launch missiles at some point in the future. They're not doing this tomorrow. They still have lots of testing left, but they're moving forward, and if they're able to launch ballistic missiles, nuclear ballistic missiles from a submarine, that definitely adds to their capability. Basically, they've been trying to do two things. With their land-based missiles, they've been trying to build launchers that are mobile so they can fire and run away before you can hit them back, yeah. Right? And similarly, with a submarine, you can position it anywhere, fire it, and run away if they don't know where the submarine is. So that's giving them more capabilities. Now, they're not there yet, but they are making progress.
Well, and by the way, what is the state of the North Korean nuclear submarine fleet? Do they have some?
No. So you can so to be clear, submarines can be nuclear-powered or non-nuclear-powered. In theory, you can fire a nuclear weapon from either type.
Uh-huh.
You don't need to fire a nuclear weapon only from a nuclear submarine.
But this summer, didn't we see pictures of Kim Jong-un, you know, bragging about a submarine?
They are bragging about a submarine, yes. And they are working on submarines, but to have a submarine fleet, you need several. You need to have at least a couple out there. You need a couple in dock that are being in repair. You need a couple that are on their way to replace the ones whose mission has, you know, come to an end. So they need a fleet, not a single one. But again, you know, 8 years ago or whatever, they didn't have any of this. And in this particular case, the missile they use is a solid-fueled missile, which, again, allows them for quicker deployment. And its range is probably the longest range of their medium-range missiles. Mm. So at every level, the type of fuel, how it's being launched, where it might be launched, they're all making progress.
So all this in the lead-up to these talks tomorrow. Yesterday, the Pentagon said that the U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper spoke to his counterpart in Japan, who are very threatened by these missile launches, by the way. They agreed that the new test was provocative. It does not set the stage for diplomacy. And yet these talks appear to be happening. And today, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said he's willing to meet with Kim. So what are your expectations for the next couple of days?
Well, I would say if we step back, this is the beginning of the final phase. You know, we've got about a year left. There's only a year left to negotiate something.
Before the election.
Before the election, right. And these things are pretty tough to negotiate. And we're really starting at the beginning. These are working level talks that should have been started, you know, 2-3 years ago after the first summit. They're finally happening. So they have a lot to do. My prediction, I'm sticking with it, there will be a third summit. It will be where the rubber meets the road.
Between the two men.
Yes, between Kim and Trump. That will happen, and then the question is whether they can get anything done. The pressure will be on Mr. Trump, though, because, again, 2020 gets closer with every day.
Well, there's already so much pressure on the president domestically. How does he get anything done of this magnitude as he's dealing with this impeachment crisis?
Well, I would hope that the working group level meetings with Steve Biegun, the special representative, who I actually think is quite good. I mean, that's the right guy in the right job right now. If they can make progress, then they can present something to the president that he can simply show up and sign. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Well, that's the way it's supposed to work.
Right. And but, of course, the North Koreans may stall, as they have in the past, because they prefer to deal with Trump one-on-one and skip the interim working group process. They'd rather get him in a room and say, hey, let's do this, and then he says yes, and they go from there. So I know we'll see the results from this first set of meetings in Stockholm that begins today, whether they produce anything. But time is of the essence. There's not a lot of time left. And, the question will be, who's going to flinch here? Who needs this deal worse? The North Koreans, who may lose Mr. Trump as a president if the election goes against him,
mm-hmm.
or Mr. Trump, who needs a foreign policy win when things are not going well in Afghanistan and Iran?
And very briefly, what's the answer to that question? Who needs it more?
I think Mr. Trump needs it more.
Huh. That's Jim Walsh, here and now security analyst. He's also with MIT's Security Studies program. Thanks as always.
Thank you, sir.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
There are places in the United States where voting districts are made up mostly of prisoners who can't vote.
Forgive me for not having been able to articulate this the way I want to, but it's almost like your body being used.
On NPR's Code Switch, the connection between the U.S. Census, politics, and prisons.
A new Pew survey finds most Americans are worried by the role that social media sites play in delivering their news. And as social media companies try to improve the quality of news broadcast on their platforms, 55% of Americans feel those attempts will just make it worse. Let's bring in Femi Okeh. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hi, Peter.
So you and I both get a lot of news from social media, but you especially. What do you make of this study?
It really, if you go look at the Pew Research website, it really crystallizes a lot of what we've been feeling about social media, but perhaps didn't have the data. For instance, where are most people getting their social media news from? Well, wherever they're playing on social media. So Facebook is up there at number one, YouTube number two, Twitter number three, Instagram number four. People, believe it or not, are getting some news from their WhatsApp. Internationally, that's a more common way of getting your news. And also Tumblr, yes, it's still alive. A few people are still getting their news from Tumblr. This survey also looks at political bias. So conservatives tend to feel that the news is more left-leaning. People who are more liberal feel that the news is pretty much fine and neutral. Hmm. So there are lots of little tidbits in there that are worth looking at. If you love news, love social media, really good place to go.
Sure. So supporters of Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, moving on to another story, I guess they would be happy with any kind of news coverage, whether it be social media or otherwise, because this week Democrats reported their third quarter fundraising numbers. Yang brought in $10 million, and that was more than Senator Cory Booker. And some of his supporters are pointing out on Twitter that he's being left out.
Indeed. In fact, some of the cable news networks have been doing a number one for Sanders, Buttigieg number two, Kamala number three, Cory Booker number four. Everybody's like, wait a minute.
And we just got Elizabeth Warren numbers too, by the way, which are near Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. So as these numbers were being updated, Andrew Yang wasn't even in any of the graphics, any of the charts at all. And so the Yang Gang, as they're known online, are very enthusiastic, very social media savvy. And so they went back to a hashtag that they've been using quite often, which is Yang Media Blackout. Let me give you a little idea here. Mike Mongo says, for the record, Andrew Yang raised $10 million in the third quarter, nearly double Cory Booker and just behind Kamala Harris. They got very agitated. Yang media blackout began to trend. And bit by bit, the media organizations, the cable organizations began to adjust their charts to put in the third quarter, Andrew Yang actually raised 10 million. Yang joked about it. He said, perhaps next time I need to raise 20 million, but also told his Yang gang that everything's been updated. Thank you very much for supporting me.
Well, he usually is pretty good natured and humorous about some of the challenges that he faces in this race. Now, Femi, I have a treat for you.
Yes,
let's
Peter.
Listen.
Look at this photograph.
Oh, I'm sorry. There are people on the other side of the glass shaking their head.
What is that?
You know who that is. It's Nickelback, which is making a comeback this week.
Takes me back.
This song featured in a video posted by President Trump. It was an altered version of the original music video depicting the band's frontman holding a photo of Joe Biden and his son Hunter on a golf course with board members of the Ukrainian gas company. Twitter removed this, said it was a copyright violation, and the president's supporters are not happy. What are you hearing?
Oh my goodness, some Nickelback not lovers anymore, let's say that. Lamont, Nickelback had a great chance to show their open-mindedness, but they blew it by asking Twitter to remove it from Trump's viral tweet. Nickelback is on tour right now, I have to say. Ashley Golden, Nickelback hasn't been relevant in years. Oh, that's a burn.
I don't know that that's true either.
Well, they're touring. They're very popular right now, but not with Ashley Golden. She says that they should thank Donald Trump for putting them in the news again. One more love for the president, hate for Nickelback. Hey, Nickelback, this is not such a good idea. I'm just going to summarize there for language. You would disable the media on this. I bought your song on iTunes 9 hours ago because I loved at real Donald Trump's tweets so much.
Wow.
And I've also been a fan of you guys. Now she wants her nickel back. See what she did there?
I do. And just quickly, what is the band saying anything about this?
The band are saying nothing. I have looked through the feed. I haven't seen anything, but Warner Music Group asked for the track to be taken off, the video to be taken down. And so now if you go back to the president's tweet, you will see that the video has been removed. So there's a big load of nothing right there.
Okay. And don't worry, people. We're not going to bring the song back. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Peter.
About half of older Americans are dipping into their retirement funds to help their grown children. That finding comes from a recent survey. And it may be part of the reason why a fifth of older Americans are still in the workforce. NPR's Ina Jaffe covers aging, and she's reporting this week on how older adults are navigating the new realities of work in retirement. Today, she introduces us to older parents of an adult child with special needs. They say retirement may not ever be part of the picture for them.
It looks like we have a lot of California poppies up here.
This Southern California Nature Preserve is where 67-year-old Steve Lusky comes to escape. Walking into a stiff wind, he points out every tiny wildflower by name.
Checker mallow. I think that's owl clover.
Lusky volunteers here on the weekends. That's after he finishes working 60 to 90 hours a week designing computer chips.
It's nice just to get away from the high-tech world. This is a way to get grounded in reality again.
Another aspect of Lusky's reality becomes clear as soon as you walk into his family's home in a small town in Riverside County, California. There are stacks of things, papers, books, storage containers on almost every surface. The Christmas tree is still up, months after the holidays are over. Steve Lusky's wife, Jean, says her husband's always working, and she couldn't take the tree down herself. She's 69 and has constant pain from fibromyalgia.
The muscles up the side of my spine are like rocks.
And it really slows her down. She sleeps a lot.
The Luskys live with their two grown sons. The older one, Ian, is 39. They describe him as being on the autism spectrum. Ian stays up all night, so at this particular moment, he's asleep upstairs. He used to live on his own. He held a job for almost a decade. But a few years ago, he was laid off and moved back in with his parents. The way Jean sees it, Ian's biggest problem isn't his disability. It's his personality.
Ian is one of these people who gets really angry easy, really frustrated easily.
And he takes out his frustration and anger on the people around him. like one time when Gene gave him an answer he didn't like.
So he just slugged me in the arm?
Yeah, he's rather abusive.
Now, aggression isn't characteristic of everyone with autism, though researchers disagree on how common it is. Estimates range from just 15% to more than half. But in the Lusky household, the relevant number is one, Ian. Gene says he's attacked his younger brother, Evan.
Evan has been to the hospital multiple times.
Evan is 34. With all the conflict at home, he's had a hard time getting his grown-up life started.
I've actually had a ridiculously long tenure in school. I've been going to school on and off for about 14 years, give or take.
Meanwhile, Dad is footing the bills. He didn't want Evan to have the burden of student loans. And Ian won't look for another job or apply for disability benefits.
The money that I give to my sons, basically to cover things like tuition here, a car there, you know, it's taking money out of retirement and, you know, some of the investments. And if that money had stayed there, that would be worth a lot of money now. Instead, it's gone.
Lusky's situation is not that rare. Nearly 1 million Americans age 60 or more are caring for an adult child with an intellectual or developmental disability.
Families really find themselves in a bind.
That's Dave Kieran, the director of adult services at Autism Speaks, an advocacy and research organization. He says a family's first financial hit often comes as soon as the child is diagnosed, and one of the parents, usually the mom, leaves the workforce to provide care, as Gene Lusky did.
So many parents make that decision. Their income is cut in half, and earnings on those retirement benefits or other assets they could use to cover some of these ongoing costs are vastly decreased.
That, plus the significant costs of raising a child with a disability, can put extra pressure on the working parent to work more hours and make more money, says Kieran.
So retirement and those visions of an empty nest and plans for what to do after the children grow up and leave the home need to be abandoned.
Fortunately for Steve Lusky, he likes his electrical engineering job. Unfortunately, he couldn't afford to buy a house near his work. So he's up and out before 7:30 in the morning to start his long commute. And then
I often don't get home till 9 or 10, sometimes much later.
That's a long day.
There's other days I'll leave the house to beat rush hour about 4:30. And still stay late at night. That's when projects really ramp up, and that'll last for months like that.
Lusky's also grateful to have this job, especially in a field considered the province of people much younger. He finds the long hours get harder year by year, but considering the needs of his family, he sees no choice but to keep going.
So here it is. We're sacrificing retirement money, and we don't see the end of this. So I don't see retiring anytime soon.
Maybe in 5 years, says Lusky, he can cut back. He should have enough money by then, if it's just himself and his wife Jean. But they're not sure it will ever be just the two of them. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Speaking to reporters outside the White House this morning, President Trump said again, there was no quid pro quo with Ukraine. That's after House Democrats released dozens of text messages late last night from top State Department officials related to the president's dealings with Ukraine. The messages show officials debating how to convey President Trump's message to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now from the White House. Franco, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's get some clarity on these text messages and exactly what they reveal. Kurt Volker, former U.S. Special Envoy to the Ukraine, provided the texts after more than 9 hours of testimony behind closed doors yesterday. And these texts span from July to September. Give us some highlights. What was in them?
Well, there was a lot. You can see how Volkner and other diplomats discussed how to navigate Trump's request for the Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden. Those discussions involved talking about a draft statement that the Ukraine government would make announcing an investigation. In return, it appeared they'd get a high-profile visit with President Trump as part of a kind of reboot of the relationship. And they appeared to be even talking about some possible dates in September.
Let's read some of the most striking exchanges. One from Bill Taylor. He's the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine. He texts Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU. He writes, quote, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." And then Gordon Sondland replies, "Bill, I believe you are incorrect about President Trump's intentions. The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind. The president is trying to evaluate whether Ukraine is truly going to adopt the transparency and reforms that President Zelensky promised during his campaign. I suggest we stop the back and forth by text." Now, Republicans and Democrats are really offering different interpretations of these exchanges. What are you hearing?
I mean, that's absolutely right. Like many things with Trump, your perspective is largely colored by whether you feel the president is being treated fairly or not. If you're pro-impeachment, you see this as extremely damning and a sign of a quid pro quo. If you're a Republican, though, and you support the president, you're pointing to Sondland's text, the one that you just read, and say, see, no quid pro quo. And Trump, even Trump, is tweeting that Volkner, during his testimony, blew a massive hole in the Democratic accusations.
A lot actually depends on what wasn't said in these messages. What are we going to hear more of in the coming days from these officials?
Well, we're going to hear a lot, you know. I mean, there's so many questions left to come out. We have, you know, there's all these issues that we're hearing from. You know, this is a messaging war. We're not waiting for a judge to make a decision. We're waiting on senators and members of Congress. And frankly, we're waiting on the American people to make a decision. And really, they're still trying to make sense of all this.
Yeah, still trying to make sense of it, trying to make sense of all of these text messages we got, even on this early state. That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
In the ongoing public health crisis over vaping, there's a new casualty: vape shop owners in Massachusetts. Some have been forced to shut down after Republican Governor Charlie Baker ordered a 4-month ban last week on the sale of all vaping products. Here's the governor on Boston's WCVB News.
One of the most difficult elements of this decision was, what about the store owners? But the flip side of that is, to continue to have the store owners sell something when I just had a whole room full of medical experts tell me that this is potentially extremely harmful and possibly fatal, and nobody really understands why, just made no sense to us at all.
Yesterday, the CDC said at least 18 people have died and about 1,000 more have gotten seriously ill after vaping. And this week, doctors at the Mayo Clinic, who examined some tissue samples, said the lungs appeared to be exposed to poisonous gases. Health officials suspect black market tainted vaping cartridges containing THC may be the cause of the outbreak, but some who fell ill reported only vaping nicotine. So the mystery persists. The investigations continue, and people like vape shop owner Stacy Peritsky are stuck. So we're in your store now,
but there's not much going on.
See that in these cases was the bulk of our products, probably 20 different devices for vaping.
Now illegal to sell in the state of Massachusetts.
Illegal to sell.
Recreational marijuana is legal in Massachusetts. Peritsky doesn't sell pot, but she's had to close 4 of her Boston area vape shops. Last year, revenue was nearly $2 million. But today, the merchandise is coming off the shelves.
These are all the juices. And this is just from this store. The other stores have equal amounts. And then these are all the coils.
Just boxes on the floor, getting ready to get shipped out of here, I guess.
Correct.
So what are you going to do with all this stuff?
Well, we're trying to see if we can sell any to stores in New Hampshire, although that could be illegal. But right now, we're sitting on it. We can't do anything with it.
You're in a tough spot.
We're in a really tough spot. We're done.
Peritsky and her business partner, David Bershad, say the ban has upended their lives and the lives of their 10 employees.
We had to lay everybody off. We had to close the stores. Literally 96% of what we sell in this store could no longer be sold. Governor Baker did the most extreme ban that's been done in the United States because he banned not only vape juices, he also vaped all the devices.
He banned all the devices. So it wasn't like other states that have banned flavored cigarettes, e-cigarettes.
And also, many other states, like New York, banned all flavors except for tobacco flavors and menthol flavors. He didn't ban the devices, but you might be able to survive with vaporizers and tobacco and menthol flavored juices.
David, what's your reaction? We're in your store. Literally, the shelves are being dismantled by your last remaining employee. How are you feeling?
It has been a little depressing and a little disappointing for our customers because they had tried all the FDA-approved smoking cessation devices. They tried the gum, the patch, Chantix, etc. No joke, I've spoken with at least 25 people since the ban went into effect who have told me, I'm back on the cigarettes. I just won out. I couldn't get juice. I'm now smoking again. I mean, to me, that's outrageous. You know, it's a tragedy that people have died. But our understanding and what the CDC has been putting out there is that 77% of those people that have come down and had problems, pulmonary problems, they believe 77% of those cases, they were caused by tainted THC cartridges that were bought on the black market.
Let's talk about the black market, right? Because before all of this started, I don't think most people really thought about a black market in the vaping industry. When you think black market, you think marijuana, something more illicit than that. Did you know it was that vibrant?
No. But there is no, the black market on nicotine liquid is virtually non-existent. Right. We never have customers coming in saying, I vape my own stuff or I get it down the street. So there is no real black market yet for nicotine juices.
There is for THC.
For THC.
So what you're saying is now with this ban and bans like this, you'll be moving people into a new black market?
100%.
I think it will happen. I mean, people's choice. Can't go to Rhode Island. We believe Connecticut will shut down soon. There are people, I mean, we know people that, customers that would come in and said, hey, you want to try my e-liquid? I made it myself. But if someone decides to just go out there and say, look, I got all these people I can sell to, how is the public to know if what they're buying on the street was made correctly?
Well, yes, it's true. Public health officials have suspected this. The CDC and the FDA have not yet gone as far as to say, yes, that is the definitive problem.
No.
Hold on. No, that's true.
Right.
No, that's true.
That is true.
That's true.
But what is true is that the CDC has said that 77% of the cases so far, they've confirmed
the THC, the illicit cartridge.
So that does leave some gray area. So, and that is the concern that the governor and other policymakers have had. They don't really know what's going on. So how can you be sure? Are you sure that everything that you sell in this store is safe to inhale?
I would love to answer that because vaping is not a hobby. People have used it to quit smoking. Is it 100% safe? I would lay my life down that our products are 95% safer, less dangerous than cigarettes.
I know you are wildly against Governor Baker's ban in Massachusetts. There are other states that haven't gone quite as far. Michigan, Rhode Island, New York, they've all said stop the sale of flavored e-cigarette products. Do you have any sympathy for any type of regulation like that as they're trying to figure out what's going on?
Well, And the purpose of that ban is to keep teenagers away from vapes. But we are a 21-plus store, and I share the desire to make sure that all of the products we're selling are perfectly safe. I think there are other ways that there are other solutions. For example, I think 21-plus stores should be able to continue to service adults who can make up their own minds.
When this ban is over in 4 months, is there any chance this store reopens?
I'm not optimistic. All of our devices in 4 months will be old school because the vape technology moves so fast.
Was that still true in this environment where there's so much regulation coming?
Yes, because there are many other countries, for example, England, which we always like to use as an example because if you go to a doctor in England, they will tell you, and you want to quit smoking, they will recommend vaping to you.
So what does that mean for you? Well, 4 months, four months passes, then what?
Our tentative plan is to hold on to one of our stores, try and run it as a head shop, which is nothing that we've ever really wanted to do, and then see where we are. But my sense is that we're not going to end up in a good place.
How much money do you think you're out?
Well, we know that we're sitting on $80,000 of inventory that we legally cannot sell. We're
so
out.
That's a bummer.
We're both 60. And basically, we've both just lost our livelihood.
I don't want to retire. I can't retire. What do I do?
Right.
Wow.
It's a real existential
crisis. I'm not
even
sure if it's hit me yet.
Right.
While we were talking, a customer walked in through the front door, which had been locked until I showed up. Sergey Mian wasn't looking for a vaping device. He wanted a glass pipe, which the shop can still legally sell.
This one right here?
That one?
Yeah.
It's a great pipe.
He didn't know the store had been shut down, so Bershad gave him a piece of paper with Charlie Baker's number on it.
Feel free to call the governor and tell him you think that this ban is unconstitutional.
Then Meehan handed over $10.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
Guys, it has been a bummer, but it's been a pleasure as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good luck to you.
All right, good luck to you too.
Other vape shops in Massachusetts are suing over the governor's ban, but if they're unable to get the stores reopened, that was the last $10 this vape shop will likely ever make.
Next month will mark 1 year since the most destructive fire in California's history, the Camp Fire. It nearly wiped out the town of Paradise and killed 85 people. But there is another community that was also devastated by fire 2 years ago. Thousands of homes in Sonoma County, California were destroyed, and folks there are still struggling to rebuild. Construction companies are just overwhelmed. And an effort is now underway to get insurers to keep paying out temporary housing benefits, which expire next week. Joining us now is Sonoma County Supervisor Shirley Zane. Supervisor Zane, welcome back.
Yes, thank you. It's nice to be back.
In talking about those insurance companies, we should mention that the state legislature and the California Insurance Commissioner's Office, they're well aware of these problems. Lawmakers did pass this law in 2017 after the fires to help give homeowners more time to rebuild. But then there are these current mandates that insurance companies continue to pay out additional living expenses to those policyholders impacted for a minimum of 3 years after the fire. It only used to be 2 years, but still there's this new law, and it's so confusing. There's this new law that was not made retroactive, so it did not help the 2017 fire survivors, the ones that we're talking about. Why was it not made retroactive?
Yeah, no, it's not retroactive, which means a lot of the insurance plans, I should say a lot. I'm going to call out State Farm because they've been the worst. They are cutting people off right now when we're coming up to the second year anniversary of the fires. These are people who are in rentals. They haven't been able to rebuild yet. Maybe they're started. And suddenly these insurers, like State Farm, are saying, well, so sorry.
We did hear from State Farm. We actually reached out to them as well as several others, including Nationwide. But State Farm actually says, in California, the California Department of Insurance reviews all of our State Farm's policies and coverages and approves all of our rates prior to use. So they're basically saying they've done everything they can And if an insurance policyholder has an issue, they will look at the claims individually, but there's nothing more they can do.
That just isn't true. Well, I mean, they can blame it on the insurance commissioner, but the insurance commissioner doesn't have a lot of teeth if there's already a contract. They really are putting our fire survivors in a horrible place because suddenly they're going to have to be paying rent and a mortgage at the same time. And they're like still 6 months or more away from rebuilding their homes, which mm-hmm. for a lot of them, that's going to be a choice if they haven't constructed yet, but they have permits. It'll be a choice of not rebuilding. There have been insurance companies such as Farmers and AAA that have extended for another 6 months the additional living expenses. But State Farm has not. Again, when they could absolutely dive into their bottom line and extend these additional living expenses for a few months, that just doesn't square with all of our survivors. We had a rally this last Friday night in Courthouse Square, and the stories are really heartbreaking. And the mm-hmm. two names that keep coming up are State Farm and Nationwide.
Mm. Now, the state insurance commissioner has tried. They asked insurance companies to voluntarily comply with the new 3-year law and told them that basically they have until October 8th to respond. What do you want the state to do to hold these insurance companies accountable? I know you say that they can only do so much, that it's in the insurance company's hands. But what more could be done on the state level to hold these insurance companies accountable?
Well, I think going forward, the new law is going to help because, you know, once you have the legislation, then the commissioner has some teeth to enforce the legislation. You know, it's one of these situations that we see ourselves a lot in these days in America, where corporations, you know, basically follow the almighty dollar and the bottom line, and they don't show that they really care about people. A friend of mine had her insurance plan with State Farm for 40-some years. She and her husband were retired school teachers. She got diagnosed with cancer 4 days before the fire, and she lost her home. 40 years, you know, where is the loyalty to those customers? Where's the human decency?
As you said, this new law will help somewhat in the future, but how much does the situation worry you about the future? This is just one batch of fire survivors. Yeah. But sadly, we may see other wildfires in the future.
Well, we may very well. We've been lucky so far this year, but, you know, that can change in a minute. And I think we're all very worried about the ability of people to rebuild their homes and rebuild their lives. And if the insurance companies want to play hardball with people who have been loyal customers for years, well, I say we give them a black eye in terms of PR. People need to understand State Farm is not a good neighbor. They've been a very, very bad neighbor.
Shirley Zane is a supervisor in Sonoma County, California. Shirley, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Nationwide has said in a statement that it was, quote, applying the appropriate coverage for each individual based on the insurance contract. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley at NPR West in Culver City, California.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.